Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's a law professor at Stetson University and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. She serves on the board of the Mertz Gilmore Foundation and the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And she's the author of the new book, Corporatocracy: How to Protect Democracy from Dark Money and Corrupt Politicians. Welcome, Chara.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with your background. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Richmond, Virginia.
And how'd you get interested in law and politics?
Well, as an undergrad, I interned for a senator and for the Department of Health and Human Services, and I caught the politic bug. And then after that, I went foolishly into law school, thinking that was the best thing to do.
Well, I feel like I should warn people that this book is not for the faint of heart. It skewers many sacred cows and exposes certain narratives and ideals about America that we've been taught to be myths. Would you read a passage from your intro?
Certainly. In the American context, corporations can erode faith in democratic institutions by trying to manipulate elected government to serve private ends. The voting public can easily lose trust in these institutions when scandal after scandal floods the news cycle. The sheer volume of the influence of money in politics from corporate treasuries and wealthy CEOs can leave the impression for voters that politics is a rigged, unwinnable game. As corporate governance guru Robert Monks worries, quote, "The unrestrained corporate hunt for profit is taking a toll on the environment and society. These are symptoms of a far greater threat to democratic society, the corporate takeover of the political process," end quote. As will be explored in this book, corporate crimes are often the precursors to violations of election laws.
That's an interesting statement. Chara, why did you write this book?
Well, I was inspired to write this book because of the events on January 6, 2021, when there was an attack on the U.S. Capitol that attempted to overthrow the outcome of the 2020 election. I had my time on Capitol Hill right out of undergrad. And while I was there, there was actually someone who tried to come onto the Capitol grounds with a gun, and he shot at Capitol police officers. And I remember going to that funeral, and which was under the Rotunda Dome. And I remember thinking during that funeral, these are the individuals who make it possible for us to have a functioning legislative branch of government. And so I was particularly heartbroken when I saw all of the violence on January 6th, because that violence was being directed at these heroes of democracy who stand up every day and put their lives on the line so that we can have a functioning government. And that was the inspiration. And because I work on the issue of money in politics, I sort of wondered whether there was a money in politics aspect to the story that was being mostly overlooked. And so that's where I started.
Well, you write, quote, "the pathetic state of American democracy," end quote. That sounds like a good place to start. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, in some ways, it's only gotten worse since I wrote this book. So I wrote this book during the Biden administration, even though a lot of the focus is on the Trump administration, part one. And now we are experiencing the Trump administration, part two. And a lot of the things that I had been worried about have sort of sadly come to pass. I mean, one of the really strange things that I'm experiencing with Trump part two is normally when you have a large campaign contributor, they will have a lot of influence over, you know, either the senator that they supported or the House member that they supported or even the president that they supported. But we are in a sort of a whole new weird territory where one of the biggest political spenders during the 2024 election is also the richest man in the world and is also sort of personally going into the government and kicking things over. And that is not a great place to be as a democracy. we should have, for one, there should be more checks and balances than we've seen in the past couple of months. Our Congress is supposed to be a check on the president. That has not happened. And a lot of what has happened in the executive branch is just completely against what Congress has mandated in law. So a really clear example of this is the destruction of USAID. That is created by Congress, funded by Congress, and it has been dismantled by this administration, and they don't have the authority to do that. I mean, there are lawful ways where if Congress agrees and the president agrees that they don't want a particular agency or they want to downsize an agency, then they can do that through law. But what they are doing right now is not consistent with law, which is why I think our democracy is just teetering, because we voted for a Congress and a president, and they're supposed to work together, and they are not doing that right now. And that is really, really troubling from a democratic accountability point of view.
Well, when the legislative branch kowtows to the executive branch and the judicial branch gives the executive branch just unlimited power, there's not a whole lot that can be done about it, is there?
Well, I have been encouraged by federal judges so far. They seem to be the ones who have been standing up and saying no, including our Supreme Court, which in some ways is the cause of all of this in terms of the things that they ruled on, both when Trump was in power and then when Trump was out of power. So one of the things that I deal with in the book is what the Supreme Court did with the disqualification clause of the Constitution. So your listeners can be forgiven if they never studied the disqualification clause in school. It is a part of the Constitution that hadn't been used in 100 years, but there was a good faith attempt to use it against Trump. And the argument there is that this part of the Constitution disqualifies oath-breaking insurrectionists. And the basic argument was that when Donald Trump was inaugurated, he swore to uphold the Constitution. And then with his actions surrounding January 6th, he engaged in an insurrection. So the voters in Colorado, who were Republicans, challenged his ability to be on the Colorado ballot. And the Colorado Supreme Court actually agreed with the voters that he was an oath-breaking insurrectionist and he was disqualified from running for president. But that then goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court reverses. And the ruling that they give is sort of deeply unsatisfying. They decide that the state cannot remove a candidate for federal office using this part of the Constitution. Now, mind you, nothing in this part of the Constitution says that, but that is the interpretation by the Supreme Court. So we're all sort of stuck with it. So if you ever wondered, you know, why Trump was able to run for office in the first place in 2024, it's that Supreme Court decision, which is Trump versus Anderson.
Well, this is the same court that basically gave Trump a get-out-of-jail-free card so that anything he does in office, he cannot be held accountable for. Is that correct?
So that's Trump versus U.S. It's a little bit more complicated than that, so I'll try to give you the simple version. The Supreme Court in that case decides that there is absolute presidential immunity from crimes if what the president is doing is a core presidential power. So if you can open the Constitution and find the power in Article 2, then when the president is doing such a thing, so exercising the pardon power, for example, a president cannot be prosecuted later for the way he gave out pardons. The court also says that there's no immunity for private action. So running for office is a private action, even if it's being done by the president. And so there is still this ability to get at purely private actions that are taken by the president. But one of the big catches is you can't prosecute a private act if the evidence for it is one of his core official acts. So this is really going to make it nearly impossible, not totally impossible, but nearly impossible for future prosecutors to go after any president for what they did in office.
My guest is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's a law professor at Stetson University and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law. She's also the author of a new book, Corporatocracy: How to Protect Democracy from Dark Money and Corrupt Politicians. So, Chara, next year is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, and the Trump administration has created Task Force 250, as an aside. It's also underneath the Department of Defense, not sure why, but it's there to coordinate activities celebrating the Founding Fathers and the Declaration of Independence and the greatness of America that's going to be promoted as a national narrative. So many of us grew up on this story of America's so-called greatest generation as the one that fought in World War II. But you offer details in your book about the little-known role of corporations that supported Hitler before and throughout World War II. These are American corporations. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the big ones are Ford and GM. And in particular, I take Henry Ford to task in this book. I mean, after doing this research, I don't understand how anyone has a good opinion of Henry Ford anymore. But I think for whatever reason, people forget. I mean, it's a long time ago. But Henry Ford was a horrible anti-Semite. He really disliked Jewish people. I have no idea what the source of this was, but it was pretty pernicious in his case. And one of the things that he did once he became a successful businessman was he bought his hometown paper. And he used his hometown paper to put out these anti-Jewish screeds, and then, like, over and over again. And he didn't stop at that. Then he had these papers bound into books, translated into multiple languages, and he purposefully didn't put a copyright on it so that they could be easily copied and distributed throughout the world. And it turns out that some of his rants make their way to Germany in German, and that one of his big fans is literally Adolf Hitler. And apparently the two men admired each other. On Hitler's desk, he had a picture of Henry Ford, and Ford gets this Nazi award during his own lifetime. So all of that was pretty awful. And then Ford uses his abilities over the Ford Motor Company to, you know, be supportive of the Nazi cause in material ways. So I think the Ford name should be Mud. I realize different generations of the family have distanced themselves from this, and sort of rightly so. But I write about that in the book. I also write about the German companies that were supporting the Nazis, and I think this is sort of another story that has just been lost to history. Essentially, in early 1933 in Germany, the Nazi Party is broke, and they turn to German industrialists from a couple of companies, the Krupp Company, the Flick Company, and a company called IG Farben, which was a chemical company. And these industrialists bail out the Nazis. They go from being in the red to being in the black. And this was all dark money.
That was almost overnight, right? That was in a year.
Yeah. Overnight. And it was dark money. So the average German had no idea that these industrialists had bailed out the Nazi Party. And part of the pitch that Hitler literally makes to them is, we want the next election to be the last election. And it was, for over a decade. And it's just one of these creepy stories of what if these industrialists had just said to Hitler, sorry, you're broke, you're not getting money from us, you know, try again elsewhere. It really could have changed history. And I sort of worry about money in politics in the United States having sort of a similar anti-democratic potential. And I think as we're sort of living through it, an anti-democratic reality.
And we should learn from Henry Ford. He bought a platform for messaging when he bought the newspaper. And now we have a very similar corollary today. We have to take a short break. My guest is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's the author of Corporatocracy, How to Protect Democracy from Dark Money and Corrupt Politicians. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's a law professor at Stetson University and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law. She's also the author of a new book, Corporatocracy, How to Protect Democracy from Dark Money and Corrupt Politicians. Now, before the break, we were talking about the corporations that bailed out the Nazis, the American corporations that were involved in supporting Hitler, how Henry Ford himself was a great inspiration to Hitler. During that time, you had the Catholic priest, Father Coughlin, who was a major voice throughout the 1930s with tens of millions of listeners each week to his radio show, and he was in support of Hitler. The famous aviator Charles Lindbergh gave many speeches in the 1930s and 40s that underscored white supremacy and his admiration of Nazi Germany. Hitler even awarded Lindbergh a medal and invited him to move to Germany. You also talk about this other aspect of our societal dynamic in America. During that time, again, so-called greatest generation, was the practice of convict leasing. You write about that in your book.
Yeah. So convict leasing starts shortly after the American Civil War. And in the South, including in my home state of Florida, there was a problem of infrastructure, which is they had prisoners and no prisons because many of the prisons and jails had literally been burned or, you know, lost to the war. But they didn't want to give up the idea of having prisoners. And you also had a lot of anti-Black animus. And all of these sort of combined into this horrible system called convict leasing. And so what a sheriff's office might do is they would lease convicts to a corporation, and then the corporation would take over the responsibility of housing and feeding the prisoners, and then could work the prisoners as much as possible. And in my home state of Florida, if you got sucked into the system, it was known as being turpentined. And that comes from a time when these prisoners would be just left in swamp trying to get turpentine out of trees. And many of them died in these conditions because there was such poor sanitation and so little food, and the work was backbreaking. And with convict leasing, it continues for decades and decades and only really ends around World War II. But I think it's one of these another lost parts of history. It's been called slavery by another name in a book by that title. And
Michelle Alexander.
Yeah, and the treatment of these men was just atrocious, and it was very racialized. Almost all of the prisoners who were in the convict leasing system were Black. And big corporations, like the precursors to U.S. Steel, used convict leasing. And, you know, that part of how they built their wealth was on the back of these Black men.
And you talk about America's railroads as well, being a huge infrastructure project. You talk about Union Pacific.
Yeah, so this is the Credit Mobilier scandal. And this is one of the Grant administration scandals. Grant, I think, was a decent guy. He had won the Civil War for the Union, but he surrounded himself with the worst people possible. And the Credit Mobilier scandal is essentially some railroad tycoons figured out ways to bilk their fellow shareholders and the U.S. public at the same time. And essentially what they did is they created one company to build the railroad for Union Pacific at inflated prices. So the whole point of this entity, which was called Credit Mobilier, was to overcharge Union Pacific for goods and services. And the way that this scandal comes to light is it finally spills into the press. But the way it sort of was kept going in real time was the robber barons who were involved were clever enough to cut in members of Congress into the scheme and the sitting vice president. So one of the ways that it kept on going for years and years and years is people in high places were also getting rich from Credit Mobilier. And I think this is one of the where people learn the wrong lesson. So it was a huge scandal for the public, but when Congress investigated itself, it basically just gave a slap on the wrist to some of the men involved and no real consequences. So I think the lesson that other wealthy people of the age would have taken Credit Mobilier is get in on the scheme. Even if it sort of blows up on you, you will get rich and there's no jail time and not many consequences. So, and that contributed to the Gilded Age being the Gilded Age. This is a moniker that Mark Twain gave this period in history where the wealthy were just benefiting from largesse of the federal government at taxpayer expense and were really bilking sort of the average consumer who would then have to pay for these railroads at inflated prices, which is, they were only inflated because the insiders were getting away with financial murder.
So widespread exploitation, widespread corruption, and this cast of characters across all the branches of governance. This, when you say we should have learned these lessons, we kind of did, and just kind of learned the lessons that you can get away with all this stuff. And in 1944, you had this year-long sedition trial of 24 members of Congress who were brought up on charges by the Assistant Attorney General of colluding with Nazi Germany and propagating Nazi propaganda at government expense all across the nation. And that year-long trial ended with the judge suddenly dying, and everybody got off scot-free. So now here we are in our modern time, and we still see Congress and the executive branch and the judicial branch and the corporations all in concert with one another, exploiting the public, exploiting the largesse. You write a chapter called Criminals in American Elections. What's that about?
Oh, man. Well, often in our campaign finance system, we end up with all sorts of criminal adjacent campaign finance problems. So one of the things that, or the pattern that I see in what inspires Congress to enact campaign finance reforms is often a huge political scandal, which is often has corporate crimes in the middle of it. So an example of that is Watergate itself. So I think of Watergate as a welter of crimes where Nixon is trying to get reelected. He cannot do it straight. So he creates a committee called the Committee to Reelect the President, otherwise known as CREEP. And then CREEP shakes down corporations for donations. And this is a problem because corporations, both then and now, are barred from giving donations directly to federal candidates, including candidates for president. And it's particularly pernicious in Nixon's case because the sitting attorney general is also running CREEP. And so he has authority over things that corporations care about, like the approval of their mergers under the antitrust law. And he could basically pinpoint and shake down particular corporations and ask them for these illegal donations because he knew that they needed approval for their mergers. And he did so. And then sometimes the requests were sort of incoming from the corporate side. So the milk producers during Nixon's reelection campaign, they really wanted a subsidy of milk, which would be at taxpayer expense. And so they offered to give the Nixon reelection campaign, to give CREEP millions of dollars to get that policy result. But it is essentially just a perfect quid pro quo where they were giving this money and they were expecting a federal action in return. And that kind of quid pro quo, I think, is what makes the average voter feel like this is a rigged and unwinnable game.
And you lead right into the corporate money that funded Trump in 2024.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's been striking, so I finished writing this book in, I think, about mid-May of 2024, so I didn't know how the election would go. I didn't know all of the late money that would come in. But in retrospect, I think the 2024 election will go down as the crypto bro election. There was huge spending by the cryptocurrency industry, and then there was huge spending from Elon Musk himself. And the combination of that, I think we will see in the coming years what things that industry wants. I would imagine they will see policies that reflect their desires and not necessarily the desires of the average American. So whenever we have big money coming into these elections, it can distort the policy choices of those who are elected.
Your section on how to fix the problem starts with dusting off the disqualification clause. Let me ask you this. Why should someone who can win an election be disqualified, even if he's a known criminal? Shouldn't voters be able to elect who they want?
Well, strangely, the U.S. Constitution doesn't have a bar on convicted felons running for office. The only disqualification we have is for these oath-breaking insurrectionists. And I think one of the interesting arguments that came up during that litigation is it's a bar on holding office, not technically running for office. And so on the one hand, you could have whomever wants to run for office. And then later you could make the argument that this person, now that they have been elected to the office and are holding the office, that is actually when the disqualification should kick in. But one of the things that the Supreme Court said in Trump versus Anderson when they decided what the disqualification clause means is they said that it's not self-executing. And so if in the future we want the ability to disqualify people under this clause, then Congress itself is going to have to pass some new legislation. And because of our prohibition on ex post facto laws, so an ex post facto law is a law that would be retroactive, whatever Congress does in the future is unlikely to cover January 6th because January 6th is in the past.
Well, you conclude, and we're going to have to conclude here in about 90 seconds, you conclude with some specific recommended reforms. What are they?
Well, I'm a huge fan of public financing. So instead of relying on private funds for elections, you offer people who are running for election either a grant to run for office, or sometimes they are done through matching funds. And I'm also a huge proponent of transparency. We need to know who is spending in politics. We have got to get a hold of this dark money problem. Both in 2020 and in 2024, there was $1 billion of dark money spent in each of those elections. And so we have no idea who was trying to influence our vote in either of those elections. And I think that's a real problem.
And that's going to both parties, right?
It is. It is.
So if everybody's in on the money and the corporations are buying the politicians, and even Trump in his previous election said he admitted straight up that he buys politicians, he buys judges. If that's the case, how do we fix that?
Well, We can also amend the U.S. Constitution to get rid of the Citizens United decision, which empowered corporations to spend as much as they want to in American elections. And that little effort is chugging along. Lots of different states would be ready to ratify such an amendment. We just need more political will. And so I think it's going to be very important who gets elected in 2026 in Congress.
Wow, political will. Well, we're going to have to leave that right there. Thank you, Chara.
Thank you.
My guest was Chara Torres-Spellacy, author of the new book, Corporatocracy: How to Protect Democracy from Dark Money and Corrupt Politicians.